I'm Sky Cubby. Welcome to Medicinal Foods Radio and the cutting edge of health and wellness for our mind, body, and spirit. For today's show, we're going to talk to an incredible Ayurvedic doctor, an old teacher of mine, Dr. John Duyard, on his new book, Eat Wheat, and the importance of digestive health. I'm honored to be a part of the United We Strike family, riding the airwaves with our other great hosts from Switzerland, the UK, Ireland, Chile, and New Zealand. I founded Medicinal Foods, sharing the ancient future of food, and started this show to help people take back their power and claim their sovereignty when it comes to health and wellness. By studying the ancient Ayurveda, Native American, Chinese herbal wisdom, while incorporating aspects of Siberian superfoods, paleo, as well as raw foods, cleansing practices, and more, perhaps most of all, just taking a non-dogmatic approach to health, I healed my own chronic illness, and I love to empower people to do the same. Take a look at the products over at medicinal-foods.com. You'll discover decadent raw chocolate, nutrient-dense superfoods, tonic herbs, medicinal mushrooms, living greens, better than coffee, and a whole lot more. Grab my free gifts there. The Cacao Revitalizing Cleanse, where we make cleansing fun by replacing a meal a day with our cacao elixir. And chia seeds, which make a great colon cleanser, decreasing the amount of food you're consuming, helping you lose weight, and leads the way to deeper, healthier cleansing. You'll also get my other freebies there, the Power of Tonic Herbs, the Cavity Healing Protocol, and my Pineal Awakening Protocol at medicinal-foods.com. My guest today is Dr. John Duyard, a globally recognized leader in the field of natural health, Ayurveda, and sports medicine, who's been practicing for 30 years and seen over 100,000 patients. Through his groundbreaking work, Eat Wheat, John has helped thousands of people to eat this forbidden food once again, getting to the root of their illness rather than the symptoms. I met John at a Pulse Diagnostic workshop in Massachusetts in 1992, and I learned to tell my mind-body type, or my dosha, as well as how my system was off, how it needed to be balanced. I even learned how to tell in advance if I was going to get sick. I then studied Invincible Athletics with Dr. John while ski racing at University of Colorado Boulder. Being a triathlete early in his life, John was always getting sick on the weekends when his body, when he didn't need to be on and perform. And he learned from an Ayurvedic doctor who basically took one look at him and found out that he was killing himself, and he learned how to be in balance. During the Invincible Athletics course, I learned how to calm my heart rate, my parasympathetic breathing rate and heart rate, and so I could just fly up the mountain, whether it was riding a bike or running while I was training. So I love how John grounds his practice in the science of Ayurveda and the most ancient form of health, or the study of knowledge of health. And he directs Life Spa and is the 2013 Wellness Center of the Year in Boulder, Colorado. So, as well as lifespa.com is the leading Ayurvedic health and wellness resource on the web. There's over 5 million views on YouTube. LifeSpa is evolving the way Ayurveda is understood around the world, and there's over 800 articles and videos there, combining ancient wisdom and modern science. Dr. John's a former director of player development and nutrition expert for the New Jersey Nets NBA team. Best-selling author of 7 health books, including what we're about to talk about today, Eat Wheat, a repeat guest on the Dr. Oz show and featured in USA Today, LA Times, and dozens of other national publications. Dr. John, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Sky. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's so great to reconnect after all these years. It's been a long time. I'm really excited to drop in on your latest book, Eat Wheat. I'm sure a lot of people listening are excited as well. So many people have abandoned wheat, who love it, just to switch to these gluten-free alternatives like, processed GMO potato, flour, gums, fillers. It seems to be defeating the intention of eating healthy in the first place. And it just seems like we've gone so far from what our ancestors ate for thousands of years. Is this imbalance and your knowledge of digestive health what inspired you to write the book Eat Wheat?
Well, I think what inspired me was that I was sort of watching the gluten-free craze gain more and more momentum. And as I, you know, what we do at lifespa.com is we take ancient principles and prove them with modern science. And the science shows in an overwhelming sense that gluten is actually, and wheat is actually, quite a healthy grain. Now, if you take that grain and you process it, like any processed food, it's going to be bad for you. So when people say wheat is bad, we're really talking about processed wheat. There's no science that shows that whole wheat is actually bad. In fact, the science shows that whole wheat actually reduces the risk of Alzheimer's disease by 53% in one study with a Mediterranean diet, 54% another study with the MIND diet, which is 3 servings of a whole wheat or whole grain per day. It shows in study after study after study that whole wheat lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes, and it also improves cognitive function. And all these things that we're being told that wheat is kind of this poisonous grain was sort of just a simplistic approach to say, hey, people feel bad when they eat wheat, so wheat must be bad. Well, I agree people feel bad when they eat wheat, but that's what we do so well in the West, is we just take the symptoms, you know, we just eradicate the symptoms and allow you to move on as if everything's been taken care of. But taking the wheat out of your diet doesn't solve a problem. It just takes the hard-to-digest food out of the diet. But there's a reason why you were not able to digest the hard-to-digest food. And that's what I was sort of, and I think the major thing was that this is now a $16 billion a year gluten-free industry. So there's just no way that those marketing dollars are not affecting the decisions that we make in the grocery store, somehow subliminally thinking that gluten-free is somehow healthier than a whole wheat kind of non-processed version of wheat. And what's even more amazing is recently, in the last 3 or 4 or 5 months, there have been a growing body of evidence, so many studies suggesting that being on a gluten-free diet could be very dangerous for you. Now, I get it. If you're celiac, for sure, then you don't want it. That's 1% of the population. We have over 60 million people who are gluten-free because they think it's healthier. And the study showed, they did a study. Here's a couple of quick studies. Study came out about 3 weeks ago with almost 200,000 people over about a quarter of a century, 25 years watching them, measuring every 4 years, checking how much, you know, their foods and what they ate. And the group that ate the most gluten had a significant reduction of type 2 diabetes risk than the people who ate the least amount of gluten. So the people who ate low gluten had more diabetes risk. A study that came out just 2 days ago was the same kind of long-term observational study over 25 or 30 years, over 200,000 people measured, that the people who actually ate the most gluten had the lowest risk of heart disease, and people who ate the least amount of gluten had the lowest risk of heart disease. So when people are eating gluten, it actually lowers their risk of heart disease and diabetes.
Wow.
And then some other things just to scare people a little bit is another study took people who were celiac and had not started a gluten-free diet, and people who are celiac who were on a gluten-free diet already, and then people who are not celiac eating wheat regularly. The people who were eating wheat regularly who were celiac and not started a gluten-free diet had four times less mercury in their bloodstream than the people who were celiac and on a gluten-free diet.
Wow.
In another study with healthy people, they found that people who were eating wheat on a regular basis compared to people who were gluten-free, people who were eating wheat had more good bugs and less bad bugs in their gut than people who were gluten-free. And in one more study, they found that people who were actually eating wheat had significantly more killer T cells, a measure for immunity, than people who were gluten-free. All of which suggests that these foods that are harder to digest, like wheat and grains and nuts and seeds, all of which have anti-nutrients on them. And, I mean, going back, say, hey, we've been eating wheat now. They found gluten in the teeth of ancient humans 3.5 million years ago.
Wow.
We didn't start hunting our own food until 500,000 years ago. Our own meat, rather, until 500,000 years ago. So it's safe to say we have about 2 million more years of genetics eating wheat than meat, which is surprising to most people, but that's the facts. So we have a lot of genetics for that, and the anti-nutrients on grains act as immune stimulants for the intestinal skin, for the gut immunity, to fire up and power up our immune system. Right, and when we did this when we killed all the bugs in like our planet by antibacterial soap and antibacterial everything and antibiotics, and we killed all the bugs, we now know that was a really bad idea. The Western people have a very lacking, diverse, weak microbiome which supports immunity. And then also it supports digestive strength. So that has weakened our ability to digest, and therefore hard to digest foods become more difficult to break down. So we blame it on the food. And those foods, which have been in our diet for millions of years, we have genetics. We have microbes in our mouth, esophagus, stomach, small, large intestines, specifically designed to engineered to make enzymes to specifically break down gluten. Gluten, not just everything, but just gluten. Specifically engineered for us to do that. So when we just take that out of our diet, acting like, no big deal, I can't eat wheat, so it's going to be a problem. We're marching down a road that we haven't marched down for millions and millions of years. And it's dangerous. And similarly, when we took cholesterol out of our diet in 1960 and said it always caused heart disease and all that, didn't have anything to do with heart disease. And then they replaced the cholesterol, the animal saturated fats, with ghee and butter, stuff like that. And they could replace it with omega-6 fatty acids, which they bleached and deodorized so they would be more stable, which they ended up being preservatives in every packaged food on the planet for the last 60 years. Every loaf of bread that stays squishy on a shelf for a month, it's got these polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are basically undigestible. No microbe on the planet wants to touch it, which is why your bread never goes bad. And that's what we've been feeding for the last 60 years, which literally is linked to the breakdown of our digestive system, obesity, diabetes, and depression. And that was a sort of a little bit of a mistake. And here we go again. Because of that same mistake, we can't digest anything. And now we're saying don't eat wheat, which is like, wait a minute. Are you really sure that we know what we're doing this time around? Because we didn't know last time.
Talk about questioning authority and thinking for yourself. I mean, we've got the pharmaceutical industry telling people to cut out cholesterol because they're going to have heart disease. When you link that action of not taking depleting cholesterol in your diet with the statin drugs, then people are getting a massive increase of Alzheimer's. So I'm glad you mentioned that part on cholesterol. I mean, cholesterol is so important for our myelin sheath and our nerve impulses, but that's another story. Our family has been shying away from gluten-free alternatives for a while, when the ones that have a ton of ingredients, and we try to stay focused on the simple one ingredient, rye or rice breads, for example, as a gluten-free alternative. However, when we visited Ecuador and Peru, we ate more wheat and cheese, for that matter, than we do here in Hawaii and in California. And our sinuses were more clear than ever before. We had felt healthier than ever. Is this mainly due to the fact that we were eating this non-hybridized wheat? And can you explain to the listeners how they can find the right type of wheat?
Well, yeah, it's really a great point. First of all, there's a lot of misunderstanding that the wheat that we're eating today is somehow different than the wheat that we ate 100 years ago. And there was a 19-year study done at the University of Saskatchewan, and they measured about 100 different strains of modern wheat and 100 different strains of ancient wheat, and they found really no genetic differences whatsoever. The study that Dr. Davis used in the Wheat Belly book, he said, well, that the wheat was genetically, you know, altered and quite different. Well, in the study that he used, he measured ancient grains and modern grains, and they were looking for grains that were low immune responders, because they were trying to hybridize new wheat that had a low immune response, didn't trigger an immune response. And they found that the ancient grains had more low responders than the modern grains, which is kind of cool. But they didn't mention, and he didn't mention in his book, that the ancient grains and the modern grains had the exact same number of high responders, which is what we want to avoid, right? The strains of wheat that have high immune response would cause more inflammation and more reactivity in your gut. Those high responders, the ancient grains had the exact same number as the modern grains. So they didn't say that. He kind of either didn't read the entire study or I don't know what happened, but that was sort of left out, letting people think that there were way less, you know, there were way more lower responders, lower immune responders in the ancient grains, therefore ancient grains are better. But that's not what we're looking for. We're not looking for low responders. It's nice that they're low responders. We're looking for the ones that have the high responders, which cause the immune reaction. So it's sort of interesting how the research has been interpreted in a way to make a case that isn't really accurate. The reality is the wheat is the same. It's the processed nature of the wheat, the lacking of the whole grains, you know, or separating the wheat from the bran and the germ and not having the oils in it and not having it be organic and things like that. A lot of people, I just wrote an article about this on my website, about why people go to Europe and they say, I eat the wheat there and it's fine, it must be so much better. Well, the reality is that the wheat there is not processed. You're not eating bread that has been cooked in a big factory that takes 2 hours to bake and lasts on the shelf for a month. You're eating bread that takes 3 days to bake and lasts on the shelf for a day, and then it's hard as rock. Mm. There's no cooked oils in it. There's no preservatives in it. There's no ingredients in it whatsoever. So you're eating bread that was made really fresh, and that's different. And, you know, depending on the strain you had in Peru, you may have had a different strain that was a natural low responder too. So it's, you know, different strains are different. And oftentimes when you go and you eat foods from a different part of the world, your immune system doesn't know those yet. So their body hasn't created an overuse type situation yet. So they can act a little bit differently and you don't begin to have problems with them, you know, right away. Let's say if your digestive system was super hypersensitive to wheat up here. And also when you're on vacation, the other factor, which is sort of no one ever talks about, which is when you're on vacation, people relax and they're sitting down and they're dining. When they're home, they're stressed out. They got to go to work. And that might sound completely weird for people, but the reality is that in Ayurvedic medicine, how you eat your food is way more important than what you eat and when you eat it. But we don't think about that at all. But taking time to sit down and relax your meal activates what's called the parasympathetic nervous system, which literally controls the digestive process. If you're stressed out on the run, go, 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 you have what's called a fight or flight response nervous system that's predominating your system, which literally turns off your digestion. If a bear was chasing you, you're not thinking about ordering pizza. You're thinking about getting up a tree and saving your life.
It's a huge point, where your mind is at and your stress levels. It's everything, almost everything when it comes to health. I notice that people, their emotions and their mind is so important, as well as, you know, when we were in Ecuador and Peru, we were hiking up 14,000 foot mountains, and a huge part of it is exercise too. If you're, if you're leading an active lifestyle, your digestion is going to be a whole lot, more on. And, so, you know, we've heard it before. The key to prevention is healthy digestion. Food combining has got to play a part here. I mean, if you're eating starches and proteins, starches have to wait to get past the stomach to the lower intestine before they can start digesting. If you don't chew your food properly, you know, and sit in that calm space and, you know, you can do experiments on yourself and see how your, how it goes in matches how it goes out. But you don't have the digestive fire in your stomach to break down the protein. If you don't have that, then you'll end up with undigested starch or undigested protein causing gas and smelly gas and all that. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, eating raw food first. In as far as cooked food, there's been studies showing that it can have irritations in create an inflammatory response. But if you eat the raw food first, it shows the inflammation has that it doesn't happen, the inflammatory response. So I'm wondering if...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. About, I mean, I've written a ton about this. There's a studies on both sides of that aisle, for sure. You can find studies that show that raw food, you know, doesn't deliver certain nutrients, like in broccoli, for example, the indole carbonyls, which are cancer-causing. They actually, I believe they're the ones that are released when you eat raw food, but then the sulfurate, the cancer-causing sulfur compounds in broccoli are only released when you cook the food. So when you look at the details of every food, it's like some like to be cooked, some don't like to be cooked. It seems to be very, very interesting. Bottom line is that when you don't digest your food well, and undigested food goes from your stomach into your small intestine, let's say wheat, for example, or gluten, for example, or the mercury from the coal mine plumes that are on every organic vegetable that require you to digest well. If they go through the stomach undigested, which is super common, then they will be too big of a molecule to enter into the bloodstream. And what they do is they get uptaken into the collecting ducts of your lymphatic system. And when the lymphatic system gets congested, that's what makes you bloat. That's what gives you a food coma, where you feel exhausted after the meal, because your lymphatic system is doing three things. It's trying to take fats, triglyceride fats particularly, and deliver them as energy to every cell of your body. And if your body is trying to deliver the good fats, but the road is blocked by a lot of undigested proteins and bad toxic fats, and that road gets blocked, and the body stores the good fats around your belly fat as a holding pattern for energy down the road. That same lymphatic system is trying to detoxify you, and it's also trying to carry your immune system. Recently, they discovered that there are brain lymphatics that they didn't even know existed until 3 years ago that drain 3 pounds of toxic chemicals and plaque out of your brain lymphatics every single year while you sleep at night. When the lymphs around your belly get congested, then the skin lymph can get congested, you can get rashes, the brain lymph can get congested, you get brain fog, and a lot of the sort of brain grain effects that Dr. David Perlmutter wrote about in his book, Grain Brain. I debated David Perlmutter. You can go on my website, lifespa.com, or eatwheatbook.com, and watch that debate where we went back and forth on the science, and David at the very end said, John's right. I choose to take wheat out of the diet. John chooses to sort of help people digest it and have a stronger digestive system. It's simple to take the wheat out of the diet, but my contention is that, you know what? Taking the wheat out of the diet doesn't really solve the problem. There's mercury on the organic vegetables. There's toxins in your environment that are getting into your blood, into your fat, to your brain that are going to cause problems down the road. So just taking wheat out may be, short-term symptomatic relief, but long-term a real, real problem. So the fundamental issue is that when the lymphatic system gets congested, that causes the food intolerances, the hypersensitivities, and the weight gain, and the bloat, and all these symptoms that we see with regard to wheat. So instead of taking wheat out of the diet, because there's other things that you're not aware of that are doing the exact same thing, why not heal and repair your intestinal skin so it's a better protective lining for you? Improve your digestive strength by beefing up your bile flow from the congested processed foods you've been eating for all these years, turn back your stomach fire back on, and I teach you how to do that in Eat Wheat with whole foods and herbs to do it naturally. And in fact, I take you through a troubleshooting process so you know exactly what part of your digestive system has been broken down. We can manipulate the body by food combining, eating this first, this first, and that first. But historically, ancient humans in an ancestral diet, they really didn't do that. I mean, rice, take rice and beans out of the diet, and it's, you really now question whether humans are here today, because it was such a staple for the population for so many thousands of years. You follow me? But even wheat, take wheat out of the diet. We're talking about when they did the study at the University of Utah on wheat, they found that ancient humans 3.5 to 4 million years ago could gather enough wheat berries in 2 hours to feed them for an entire day. They take it, grind it, make a mush out of it, and eat it. And the entire continent of Africa, don't forget, was covered with grass, barley, and wheat. So it was a lot easier to just sit in some tall grass, chew on some wheat berries and some barley berries than trying to, you know, kill a lion or something. They didn't have those skills for another 2 million years. So what the hell did we eat for 2 million years before we started hunting?
Our bodies have been evolving with this for two million years.
So to think, if the whole continent was wheat berries, you think maybe we ate them? Well, studies now show they found the gluten in the teeth of ancient humans. It's such a surprising thing that we have this scientific kind of aversion to telling people that we actually ate grains for a longer time. We created about 1 to 2 million years ago, the human body or the ancient human body created a gene to make its own amylase about 1 to 2 million years ago. Amylase is an enzyme specifically engineered for starch and wheat. A deficiency in the amylase enzyme is linked to Baker's asthma. Yeah, certain people don't make enough amylase. They can't handle or even be around wheat. So we created a gene specifically to make amylase. Why do you think we did that? Because we thought we might someday eat some wheat or eat some starch? No, because we ate a ton of it, and it was a genetic adaptation to a diet that was available to us, and we adapted to that environment, which was an entire continent full of wheat berries, basically. Hard to ignore.
You know, the debate at lifespa.com between the two of you, eat wheat and grain brain, is a dynamite debate that I suggest everyone to go to LifeSpa and check that out, because it says a lot. Now, gluten allergy is a real thing. However, what we're talking about here is that digestive imbalance can be disguised as a gluten intolerance, right? Like, thus, is it possible to have a gluten allergy even if you don't have celiac?
Well, no question that celiac is an autoimmune condition, and that, I mean, you know, interestingly, is that sourdough bread done cooked for 3 days has been rendered the gluten so non-existent that it rendered the bread gluten-free. They gave it to people with celiac, and they had no problem eating sourdough bread, believe it or not. Now, right. I'm not suggesting people with celiac eat sourdough bread. They should stop eating wheat, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't strengthen their digestive system, because there was a weakness that set them up for that genetic expression in the first place. People who are gluten sensitive, which is a lot of people, eat gluten, they feel like they're gaining weight, they get fat, they feel bloated, they get brain fog, they have rashes, they have real issues. And then we got to troubleshoot why that is. And the first place to look always is the gallbladder and the liver. The liver makes bile. The bile is like a Pac-Man gobbling up toxins and chemicals and pesticides out of your liver and into your intestine, like scrubbing parasites in your intestine, like cleaning all the villi so the lymphatic connections are all nice and clean. But if your liver got congested because of a bunch of processed foods, chemicals in your diet, and all the undigestible fatty acids that they put as preservatives in our food, the number one surgery today, abdominal surgery today, elective abdominal surgery, is gallbladder surgery.
That's insane.
We are at an epidemic level. It is insane. And the bile not only is help you digest, we always think bile emulsifies fats. Well, bile is also a buffer for the stomach acid, which you need to break down the anti-nutrients on grains like wheat, hard to digest proteins and dairy, nuts and seeds and things like that. So if you don't have really good bile flow, you get nauseous or bloated or brain foggy or tired when you eat fried food. Not that that's good for you, but it's a sure good test for a strong liver and a strong gallbladder. If you can't do that, then you're not having enough bile to buffer the acid. And the stomach's going to go, hey, I just ate a ham sandwich and I need 4 ounces of bile. And it sends a message to the liver and says, I need some bile. And the liver goes, well, we're a little congested down here. Sorry. She's constipated and the toxins are in my liver now and I'm a little bit congested. So the stomach says, okay, well, I'll just wait and I'll hold on to all this food until you guys get the bile thing together and turn the green light on when you're ready. And of course, the green light never turns on. Stomach holds on to all the acid, end up getting indigested and burping and gas. And Ayurveda calls it upward moving vata, where you get this heartburn and this reflux pushing up into your esophagus. And then finally, the stomach says, this is crazy. I can't continue to do this. So it starts to turn down the production of the stomach acid. And now we have a lack of bile flow, which regulates your bowel movements, your detoxification ability, your ability to digest fats and deliver them. And buffer acids, that's been gone. That's gone south. And now your stomach starts saying, hey, there's no bile down there. I can't continue making the acid. I'm going to turn off the acid production. So now your ability to digest anything hard to digest or any toxic environmental pollutant to the tune of 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals dumped in the American environment every single year, 62 million of them are cancer-causing. We have to digest those, believe it or not. Our digestive strength is linked to our ability to detoxify, which is why I say, just taking the weed out, yeah, great, do it. But fix the problem, because your ability to detoxify is linked to your ability to digest that hard-to-digest stuff. And that's exactly what happens, is the gallbladder gets congested and literally shuts down the entire digestive detox process. So that's where we need to dig in, is to, you know, say, hey, what can I do to get my gallbladder kicking in? Well, beets and artichokes and fenugreek and turmeric. Fenugreek increases the contraction of your gallbladder by 75%. Turmeric does it by 50%. Artichokes, great bile scrubbers. Beets, my favorite. You can just do beets and apples and celery juice in the morning. All those are what are called cholagogues. They flush and clean out your liver and your gallbladder and get that whole thing moving for you. I actually wrote a whole course and free ebook called Safe Liver Cleansing. It teaches you how to do really safe liver cleansing versus just sort of doing what's on the web today, which is sort of randomly going in there and just clobbering your liver and your gallbladder without knowing if your body is ready for it. And that's a free ebook for folks to know about. Many, many, many ways. And like, and even in my Eat Wheat book, I take you step by step troubleshooting what part of your digestion has gone to become weak and how they can reboot and strengthen it.
That's great. Being able to cleanse our liver, gallbladder in an easy, efficient way, and by eating foods to prepare yourself for that flush, it's priceless. I mean, we're trained in our school system to flush the radiator and oil in our car, and people do that religiously. When's the last time we flushed our liver, kidney, and gallbladder? So it's amazing.
I always say, Sky, that when not eating the packaged food, the loaves of bread we've been eating for 60 years, and if you just look at the ingredients in your stuff, it says anything, if there's any of ever a vegetable oil, could be organic, expeller, press, canola oil, don't eat it. If it's in a packaged food, it's there to preserve it. It's there to extend the shelf life, not your life. And that stuff for 60 years is like never cleaning your stovetop for the last 50, 60 years. Imagine how greasy it is. We did dissection when I was in school, and we would stick your hand in somebody's liver, and it is the greasiest, slimiest organ on the planet. I mean, it's so greasy. And if it's bad grease and bad oil, you're in trouble.
Well, any oil that's heated turns carcinogenic. So either you put a bunch of oil and bake the bread, it's pretty obvious what happens. Now we've got Monsanto breeding the glyphosate oils pesticides into foods, and obviously we want to go organic. But back to the question of what is the right kind of wheat to eat, would you say spelt and any ancient grain like kamut would be a good start?
Well, spelt is a really great grain because it's really low in phytic acids, and a lot of people don't have that digestive strength to break down the phytic acid. So that's a great grain to start with. So it's because it's so much easier to digest. Rye bread is really significantly lower, good for your blood sugar. So that's a grain that is really good for your blood sugar. I did a podcast with the oldest Kamut wheat farmer on the planet. Super, super great podcast. You can watch that podcast and learn about ancient grains. And Kamut is a fantastic wheat. And the reason why camo is so good is because it has so much more of the anti-inflammatory. I did a study with camu wheat versus modern wheat. And guess what? The camu wheat had twice as much gluten in it than the modern wheat. Twice as much gluten, right? Gluten's supposed to be the bad thing, right? But it had twice as reduction of inflammation. It lowered cholesterol and lowered blood sugar significantly more than the modern wheat. So how does the grain with twice as much gluten have twice as much anti-inflammatory properties if gluten is really the problem? It's not. So camu, because it's such an ancient grain, and the ancient grains are really cool because they have more antioxidants in them than some of the modern grains. That's definitely a difference. But genetically speaking, they're really not, there's really, you can, if you get good quality organic whole wheat, and when you make bread, for example, all you really need is organic whole wheat, salt, water, and maybe a starter. And that kind of bread can take up to 3 days to bake. And that would be great bread to eat, organic whole wheat, salt and water. And that's all you should see, unless you see, like, sometimes they'll do sprouted grains and they'll mix some different grains. And like the Ezekiel bread is great. You won't see any cooked oils in them. That's the killer. And any ingredient that you never, that you don't understand or never heard of, don't eat it. But bread is really simple. It's bread, wheat, salt and water. You make bread. So yeah, you don't need those oils to cook it. Yeah.
So yeah, let's be clear. Spelt and kamut, this is, these are different, forms of, ancient forms of, wheat, but, you know, it's, I've always liked the buttery richness of spelt, and kamut definitely seems a little heavier, but, has its place.
Yeah.
And, so when we're talking about food combining, this is, something that may help someone who's got digestive issues. But once you got that digestive fire burning, you know, my wife is a pitta, body type, and she'll eat a fish taco like it's nothing. And, you know, she can handle that starch and protein. She burns right through it really fast and doesn't have that kind of digestive issues I might have if I combine, you know, some heavy starch and heavy protein. But I'd like to get into and touch on the warming spices to get that fire and agni going for people. Things like black pepper, cinnamon, ginger, which has been called the universal medicine, cardamom, fennel. I've been tempering these spices out with ghee and greens like chard. And that's how I healed my digestive health is, putting in the ghee with these spices to pull out the medicine and then infuse the greens with them. So, do you think the anti-inflammatory, and of course, khichri, I've got a great khichri recipe on my blog at medicinal-foods that came from a master Ayurvedic chef. And so do you think that with these anti-inflammatory aspects and all the studies around the oils and the medicinal seeds, that alone could far outweigh any inflammation that comes from the cooking of the food, don't you think?
Well, for sure. You know, the vegetable oils, when you go down the grocery store aisle and you see all the clear bottles, they're vegetable oils. They come from seeds. And there's anti-nutrients and antioxidants around those seeds to protect the oil. If you take that oil out of the seed, it's going to go rancid very, very quickly just from the air, and one photon of light will do the trick. So they bleach the oil, deodorize it, and make sure there's nothing in it that can go bad. That's the stuff they put in the bread. That's the stuff that's really deadly for us. And it lowers cholesterol, which is why they loved it as a replacement. But it actually raised heart disease. They didn't know that, but that's what it ended up being.
So
it's
sort of like that get really rancid fast that we should maybe avoid.
Well, sunflower oil, safflower oil, canola oil, olive oil. If you get really, it's really difficult. You have to get good quality olive oil, which is very, very important. But like you said, if you just use the seeds themselves, like we use a formula called the five spices that I write about in the book, which is ginger, cumin, coriander, fennel, and cardamom. And it's really interesting when you look at the science behind each of those five spices, ginger, cumin, coriander, fennel, and cardamom, individually, they're all amazing for the digestive system. But when you put them together, they become something magical. They actually help to boost this production of your own stomach acid, increase the production of your own bile, your own pancreatic and duodenal enzymes, support the drainage of your own lymphatic system so you can get on them, reset, get off them and get better and not be dependent on a pill or a powder. That's the value of whole foods and whole herbs, because you're not creating dependencies as you would with taking hydrochloric. People do that all the time. They go, well, I can't digest, so I take hydrochloric acid and I take digestive enzymes. Okay, well, that's the digestive enzymes are doing the digesting for you, and the hydrochloric acid is putting acid in your stomach for you. What if your liver and your bile wasn't really produced, and your stomach said, I'm going to stop producing the acid because there's no bile to buffer this acid, and you go ahead and pour hydrochloric acid in your stomach trying to amp up your digestive system, and the stomach's going like, who did this? Like, I turned the fire off like months ago. Like, why are starting a fire in here? It's going to cause an ulcer, cause real problems. So we have to think of the body in sequence, in logic. First, detoxify the liver, get the bile to flow. Once the bile is flowing, then turn the fire on using whole foods, whole spices like ginger, cumin, coriander, fennel, and cardamom. We have a product called Gentle Digest, which is amazing for gas and bloating. And it's so gentle, and it's just those five spices. So those are powerful ways, just like you're using in your practice, powerful ways to help people get their digestive system back on track. But it's a coordinated effort between turning the stomach fire back on with those spices, you know, healing the liver and the gallbladder like we talked about, repairing the intestinal skin with things like khichdi. We have a formula called with slippery elm, marshmallow, and licorice root, which is like putting a big Band-Aid over your entire intestinal tract so the skin of your intestinal wall can heal. There's what are called colonizing probiotics that actually stick to your gut wall and create permanent residence as opposed to being dependent on a probiotic for the rest of your life, which is like the new trend right now. So there's so many ways to do this right and not, you know, just kill the bad bugs and think we've done. We can do that with a lot of really good, you know, herbal things. A lot of the herbs are very, very harsh for the intestinal skin, and we are very heavy-handed when it comes to rebooting digestion, and we need to dial that back down and realize that those bugs in your gut are super, super delicate. They feel everything that you think. They feel and morph based on what you see. If you put the poop of an anxious mouse in a calm mouse, the calm mouse gets anxious. What you watch on TV is being actually morphed by the bugs in your gut are actually changing based on what you're experiencing. Because that's what bugs do. They transport information about the outside world. Is it super stressful? Is it super calm? If it's stressful, say if we see it a lot, like CNN, then we better tell the genetic code, this is some weird stuff out there. Get ready because this might not be the end of it. And we better be genetically prepared for changing that. That's how it works. So what we see, we become. And so when we just, you know, hose out the intestinal tract with aggressive colonics or take these really aggressive herbs to kill parasites and things, we have to be careful. There's time and place, but kind and gentle is the way that gets people self-sufficient. I've been treating digestion for more than 30 years now, and that's what I've learned over the years. Is you know, you give people these anti-candida agents or anti-SIBO agents, the rifaxin, and they get better for a week or two, a month or two, and then they're right back where they started from. It doesn't solve the real problem.
Yeah, it's amazing how people can overdo things and become you know, dogmatic with certain practices. It can be self-defeating as well. But and I like the Ayurveda and the gentle aspect of cleansing. And once you can get to a point where you cleanse the liver, gallbladder, and you see 50 to 100 pea to quarter size gallstones effortlessly leave your body. It's amazing that people can do something like that and save themselves down the road from having to get their gallbladder cut out. So doing, yeah. I mean, a combination of these things, it's pretty exciting that, what people can save themselves later on. At Medicinal Foods, we talk about the ancient future of food. So what do you think about leaky gut healing through the ancient practice of eating bone broth soup?
I think, you know, bone broth soup, khichdi, many, many ancient practices of, you know, repairing and healing the intestinal skin. I mean, there's a study showed that the aging process is linked to three things. One, the health integrity of your intestinal skin, the health integrity of the lymphatic system, which has now recently been deemed the 79th organ of the body, the health integrity of that lymphatic system, which in Ayurveda is the very first system we treat, which is the drains of the body and the immune system of the body, and the microbes inside the gut, which depend on lymphatic drainage off the intestinal tract and the intestinal skin. those three things are linked to the aging process. So that's what we have to heal and repair first. So I use like a very concentrated tea using slippery elm, marshmallow, and licorice root. You can get the recipe and how to cook that up on my website. You take little teaspoons throughout the day, coating the intestinal tract, bone broth soup, khichdi, herbs that are very kind and gentle, like amalaki and neem, and brahmi, which is Centella asiatica. So many really cool herbs to repair the intestinal skin. I put all my eggs, once your digestive system is working, your liver is functioning, your stomach acid is firing, all my eggs go in the basket of protecting and repairing your intestinal skin. You take your intestinal tract, Sky, and you flatten it out. All the little villi in there is as big as a tennis court. As we age, the functional part of that intestinal skin becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. We lose the ability to deliver nutrition and get rid of waste. And you can watch that as people age. They start to get wrinkled and dry, and they become toxic, and then bad things happen. So the more we can do to protect the intestinal skin, the longer we're going to last.
And it's a good point about the lymph, because the lymph doesn't move itself. That's why we got to get out there and move our bodies.
And move,
just
right.
Walking and swimming are amazing ways to cleanse that lymph. So in reference to these spices, I mean, we're talking about tempering them in, you put a little ghee or coconut oil in the pan, you put the mustard seed if you're doing that first so they pop and you don't have gas from it. And then you can put these whole seeds in there, first the seeds, then the powders, then you can grate some fresh ginger and turmeric. But we can also get your spice package. What is it called? Available at your...
It's called Gentle Digest.
And you can just sprinkle that on your food.
Or you can take it as a capsule. It comes in a capsule, and you can open up a capsule and cook with it. You can just take a capsule before the meal. A lot of times it's just easier to have a capsule in your purse and just take a couple before you go into a restaurant and maybe amp up your digestion before you eat your food.
And you can feel that digestive fire. It's amazing because you feel warmth, and you kind of have this peaceful, warm feeling. Now, do people, depending on their dosha or mind-body type, to enhance their digestion, do they need different herbs per different person, or does that five kind of work for everybody?
Well, the five is really good for everybody. There are different formulations for sure. People with a lot of pitta who have a lot of acid-related issues, the Gentle Digest could work, but there's a formula with amalaki and an Ayurvedic combination called Adipatakar we call Cool Digest on my website, which is really good for the pitta digestion. And then for people who are kapha, really boggy, they need to really fire up their digestion. There's one called Warm Digest, which is a combination of black pepper, long pepper, and ginger. So it's a little bit spicier. But the one that's sort of in the middle for everybody is definitely the Gentle Digest. It's super kind and gentle. And it's just those five spices ground up in a capsule. Super simple, but then the results of that are, and the science behind it is just amazing.
Nice.
And that's the cool thing about it. You get on it, you get better. And instead of taking a digestive enzyme, why not help your body? See, people make the digestive enzymes, but the digestive enzyme tube that carries the enzymes from your pancreas to your small intestine, before it goes into your small intestine, in 91% of the people, it hooks up with your bile duct. And if your liver is congested and your bile is viscous or sludgy, which is super common, then the bile can't get there. And the pancreatic enzymes can't get there. So then you say, well, people get old, they can't make any enzymes. That's not true. The tubes are clogged. But so we say, take digestive enzymes. And I'm like, why not clean out the tube? Fenugreek, cinnamon, all those spices we mentioned, beets, they're cholagogues. They'll open up those bile ducts, get the bile to flow, and then you make your own enzymes and deliver. Because if you don't make those enzymes and that tube is clogged, you just take digestive enzymes, what happens? And this is dangerous. The pancreatic enzymes that you made in your pancreas, if they can't get into your small intestine because the road's blocked, they're going to back up into your pancreas and literally digest your pancreas. And that's the cause of pancreatitis and diabetes. You don't want that. So just to say, well, I can take digestive enzymes, I feel better, without fixing the cause, there's risks involved with that. There's always risks when you just put out the fire and treat the symptom. That's why I wrote Eat Wheat. I want people to get to the cause of the problem and live a healthy, happy life.
I'd like to spend some time kind of rapid fire, go through some objections that a lot of people have about eating wheat and maybe some other issues, and just see if we can, you know, spend a few minutes on this. But first, what you were talking about having to do with the beets. A lot of people say, well, beets have a lot of oxalates. What do you feel about oxalates?
you know, beasts have oxalates, or most of, so many foods have goitrogens. If you look at the toxins in food that we eat, we've been eating for millions and millions of years, there's nothing that we eat today that isn't toxic or was hybridized to get most of the toxins out of potatoes and tomatoes, for example, were deadly. Potatoes were deadly in the 1800s. So we still, and that's the whole thing about wheat. The anti-nutrients, they call them toxins, but those toxins on those anti-nutrients, the phytic acid, were shown to cause reverse colon cancer. So we have adapted over millions of years of eating foods with food toxins, you could say, and they have become a very, very important part of our immune strength. We have 300 and counting taste buds for bitter taste, because bitter can either cure you or kill you. We have one taste for sweet. Anything sweet, going to be great, not going to kill you. We love it. We've been after that taste from the first taste of mother milk a couple of million years ago, and we've mastered that taste. But okay. Bitter... Yeah. Is very unique and different, and we've adapted all kinds of internal microbial mechanisms to handle it. So to say that the oxalates are bad, they're bad if you're toxic. I mean, turmeric, for example, turmeric has a lot of oxalates in it, but it also has antioxidant compounds in there that neutralize the oxalates in it. So let's be careful before we just blame one chemical in a food when there's other chemicals in the food that often negate that chemical.
So you throw lectins and maybe in there as well as what else am I thinking about? Let's just go on to the, because lectins, they say that's hard to digest as well. But since you're talking about sugar, how about what do you have to say about sugar belly? Why you say it's sugar belly rather than wheat belly?
The evidence that he used in the wheat belly book, sugar belly, whatever it's called, wheat belly, says that wheat sugar produces opioids, or wheat has opioids in it, and therefore makes people addicted to wheat. So they gave people anti-opioids, the opioid blockers, and people stopped eating wheat by like 50%. Well, I think it was like 30% actually. Well, guess what? Mother's milk has opioids in it. Spinach has opioids in it. Many vegetables do. Tomatoes do. Meat has opioids in it as well. And they gave people opioid blockers, and they reduced their consumption of meat by 50%. They reduced their consumption of all foods by 50%, because food delivers this happy feeling. So to say to you, again, here we did. We used one study that says sugar or wheat has opioids in it, and therefore it's bad for you. Well, mother's milk has more opioids in it than wheat does. Does that mean it's bad for us? I think that the reason why things have opioids in it is because we're supposed to eat them, and that makes us come back for more. And it was part of our survival to do that. Those were our foods that we knew weren't going to kill us, right? So it's just sort of an interesting way of using the science when you don't look at the whole scientific picture and say, yeah, meat has opioids in it, and people will take opioid blockers, stop their meat consumption by 50%. Well, how can you use the same study for wheat and say that it's now wheat and meat bad? Everybody that's off of wheat's eating a lot of meat, and that's when there's a lot of questions about whether that's really healthy for you. So I just feel like a lot of studies have been used in those books to make a case that was based on this very simplistic understanding. Wheat, people feel bad, they get bloated, they gain weight, therefore wheat must be bad. And take it out of that. It's a very medical concept. Yeah, take wheat out of your diet, you'll be fine. Well, I did that 30 years ago, and I found that people weren't fine. They got better, but then they got worse again. Then you take something else out of the diet, they get better, and they get worse again. So I figured out how to understand the body in a deeper, more causative way and fix the real problem. And Western medical doctors don't do that generally. They just treat symptoms. And we have now a $16 billion a year industry based on that very simplistic view of the human body. I hate to be frank about it, but that's the fact.
Well, like you said, $16 billion industry, and the dairy's a couple billion dollar industry. And here we are realizing people can eat wheat. However, it sounds like they got to do their work. They got to do the cleansing.
Yeah.
We're not just saying, you know, hey, you know, it's fine, wheat's fine. Go out and all you people with severely impaired digestive dysfunction, go ahead and eat wheat and you're going to be fine. You got to do the work to get that fire going and get that cleansing going, to cleanse and then rebuild with the healthy probiotics and good microorganisms. But
not being able to digest wheat is a wake-up call for us to say, hey, we got to stop treating symptoms and fix the real problem, because it's so linked to our ability to detoxify. And in a toxic world, our digestive strength is more important than ever.
And you would say the same as well for people who may have lactose intolerance or just issues with milk, that once they get the digestive fire going, they can handle having a wheat chapati and a little bit of chai with some milk, maybe not with your meal, but maybe a little bit beforehand to stimulate the digestive fire, that people can experience the same ability to digest the milk as they go to the root and heal their digestive issues at the base, right?
To a certain extent. I mean, there are definitely people who don't make the enzyme, the lactase. There's a thing called lactase persistence, and a lot of people, actually Northern European descent, they have the ability to actually digest milk after, you know, they're weaned and as an adult. So a lot of people may have some trouble with that. But again, milk is sugar, fat, and protein. So you have to say, well, a lot of times their issue is the fat, which is the gallbladder issue. A lot of times it's the sugar, which is another liver issue. So a lot of times what you're blaming, and a lot of times it's the milk in a highly processed form, which is indigestible. So we have to be careful what we're saying. Like, you know, raw cheese or yogurt or kefir, things that have been fermented, actually the fermenting process, which is generally how milk was traditionally eaten, not drinking big glasses of milk. You know, actually the fermenting process, cheese making process, actually gobbles up the casein, gobbles up the lactose, and renders it casein lactose free. So for most people, raw cheese, this is legal now in America, you can buy at any health food store, has been sitting around for at least 3 months to make it basically lactose free and casein free. You have trouble eating that, you've got a gallbladder issue.
It works better for me, for sure, raw dairy. And so I guess we can say it's not lactose intolerant people that can all of a sudden eat milk. It's, you got to figure out if you are someone
right.
like myself who has dairy issues, when I have raw milk and my digestion's strong. You know, we've got the Krishnas down the road, and we get amazing raw milk from them, from their,
right.
They feed their cows wheatgrass, for crying out loud.
Wow.
And, it's actually, you know, it can just help your overall ability to digest that. But, John, I want to thank you personally, because you were a huge part of my, healing and my journey towards health. Definitely. Those years, 20 years ago plus, doing the Abhyanga massage and all the different Ayurvedic practices you taught me really helped me come into balance and to heal a lot of inflammatory issues with asthma, you know, lung infections, different kind of chronic illness that had stuck with me. So, thank you. And I really appreciate you being here. Is there any last thoughts or some information you want to get out to the listeners of how they can reach you?
Well, I think, you know, it's time for us to demand whole food, real food again. I think that's the big piece. You know, fix the underlying problem. Don't treat the symptoms. And you can get tons of information. We publish a video newsletter 3 times a week at lifespa.com, where we prove ancient wisdom with modern science. It's the combination of the both of those, which is great. And of course, the book is Eat Wheat. You can find that there too. If you want to go right to our book website, it's eatwheatbook.com. Of course, the book's on Amazon. And like I said, it's a troubleshooting guide to help get your digestion back on track. If you want to get, you know, spoon fed, how to get this thing back working and eat whole foods again and break bread again in season, non-processed version, then that's a great place to start. And thank you, Sky, very much for the interview and the time, and so good to reconnect again.
Great, and I'm looking forward to our health summit next year in Hollywood at the Wanderlust Studios. We're going to be talking about invincible immunity and everlasting energy. So until then, so long, folks, and aloha, Dr. John Douyard.
Aloha.
All that falls shall rise again. Watch the reins carve veins in time. Count the rings on the tree of life. I will remember what I've learned. I will shine when I return. I will remember what I've learned. I will shine when I return. The seed, and then the stem sprouts the leaves. First the roots from the seed, and then the stem sprouts the leaves. Rattlesnake, shed your